My mentor in Finland and professor was a great Finnish architect, the counterpart of Alvar Aalto, Aulis Blomstedt, who was married to the youngest daughter of Sibelius, and his elder brother was a famous conductor in Finland. So, and I became so close to my professor and mentor that in the final end we were almost like brothers, although we had a 30-year difference in age. At any rate, he had the same interest of philosophizing about architecture in a way that he's very close to making architecture itself, not a separate discipline. And whenever he was introduced as a theoretician, he got very anxious or nervous about it. And he usually answered by explaining that the meaning of the Greek word theorein is looking at something. And in that very sense, I accept the description of a theorist for myself. I'm looking at architectural phenomena. And as you might know, that in phenomenological philosophy, Edmund Husserl, the founding father of phenomenology, he described the phenomenological method as a way of looking at things, an innocent way of looking at things. So I come to this my position of examining architecture from two directions: the original meaning of theorem, and then the phenomenological perspective. I grew up during the war years at my grandfather's farm, very tiny, humble farm, and I can say very sincerely that my phenomenology is a farm boy's phenomenology, looking at the world, the causalities of the world, and trying to understand the essence of things. I wrote my first phenomenological essays before I even knew the word. Actually, one of the essays, which is entitled The Geometry of Feeling, is often published nowadays in anthologies of architectural phenomenology in various countries. That is an essay which I wrote before I knew anything about phenomenology. I have never studied philosophy formally in a university, which has made me a little bit nervous about going so far into the field of philosophy, until I have realized that philosophy is not a science. Philosophy is one area of literature, and it is essentially autonomous, individual, critical thinking. That's what it is. So anyone can be a philosopher. It's justified to be a philosopher. And as it happened half a year ago, five of the best-known phenomenological philosophers nowadays in the world wrote a letter to me and asked me to participate in a book on the philosophy of place that they are writing. So that was my graduation or acceptance in the philosophical circles. What I want to emphasize is, at least from my point of view, that the integration of things. I think in our culture there is a tendency to separate things too much. For instance, separate as I said in the very beginning, theorizing and making. And that is partly due to certain distortions in Western thinking traditionally, since the ancient Greeks, for instance. The hegemony of vision, already Aristotle presented a hierarchy of the senses, the eye, vision being the most important sense for Aristotle, and touch being the least important. And Aristotle saw the lack of importance in touch in the fact that even animals can feel, so it was a lower sense. As has happened to me during the past 20 or 30 years, I have almost reversed the patterns of thinking so far. And I would now say that touch is the most important of the five Aristotelian senses. It is the only integrating sense that integrates our existential experience, the existential experience, which I think is fundamental in architecture. As far as I'm concerned, architecture is not fundamentally a visual art. It is an existential expression. You might recall that Walter Benjamin, in his writings in the 1920s, compared cinema and architecture and claimed that both are tactile arts, which was a quite surprising argument at that time. And I had difficulties 25 years ago to accept and understand it, but now I fully do. But as far as senses are concerned, I'm nowadays writing about at least 10 or 12 senses. There is a recent book entitled The Sixth Sense Reader, where one of the writers classifies 33 systems in which we are in sensory relationship with the world. So I'm suggesting that in order to be successful as architects, we would need to understand or grasp 33 sensory modes of being related with the world. But there are also other aspects where I have found myself reversing the common thinking. One is, of course, the Cartesian idea of body and mind. Has become very clear to me that we have an embodied mind and a minded body. The two are absolutely linked, and there is no separation between the two. I often use the image of the Möbius strip, you know, the miraculous figure eight shape, which has two sides but only one surface. For me, the mind and the body are related in the same way. When looking at a certain point, they are different, but then eventually they become fused and they are one and the same thing. For me also, another polarity which I have completely discarded is the polarization between the world and the self. We tend to think
between the void and
self
and the self.
The self. The world and the self.
The world and the self.
Yes, we tend to think, and I think it's a normal way of thinking in Western mentality, that we are placed or located in space, or we are located or placed in the world. But in fact, there is no separation even there. The self and the world are similarly a Möbius strip which has only one surface. The self becomes the world and the world becomes the self. Of course, when you begin to turn conventional ideas or ideas that you believe in as a young architect, your entire world begins to change. And this is true in my case. For me, architecture is increasingly a mental thing. the material essence of architecture only mediates mental interactions. There is an interesting theory which Edward D. Hall mentions in his book, The Hidden Dimension, written in the mid-60s, a book that every student of architecture should read. He points out that in art history there's a curious discrepancy between the time, the period when human figure was perfectly represented in sculpture and then in painting. There is 1,000-year time difference between artists achieved perfection in representing human figure after Greek sculptors did it in sculpture and painters did it in painting. And it's very difficult to understand why that would be the case. And the theory is that sculpture for the Greeks and in the early cultures was not a visual art at all. It was a muscular art, which was communication from the muscles of the sculptor to the muscles of the person looking at the piece of art. And I have become increasingly interested in such ways of communication which bypass words in the first place, but also bypass normal channels of communication. This gets me to say something about neuroscience. As we all probably agree, architecture is a very complex and I would use the word impure discipline. It is impure in the sense that it combines aspects which are completely irreconcilable. It combines aspects of rationality and technology and economy and social issues and what have you, with metaphysics and aesthetics, etc., etc. Just tens and hundreds of categories which belong to philosophically to entirely different levels. So how is it possible to say something, anything meaningful, or do anything meaningful as an architect facing this dilemma of an impure discipline? I think we can make sense of architecture simply by confronting architecture as human beings, confronting them as entire human beings as an existential encounter rather than intellectualizing the part. I don't want to be critical about intellectualization. I consider myself an intellectual. I rather say that intellectualization easily becomes alienated from a sense of life. And to understand architecture is it entirely depends on how we understand its relationship to human culture and life. In many ways, for me, architecture nowadays is more a choreography of life than an aesthetic discipline. The aesthetic aspects are consequences of this choreography of life. Well, as you know, architecture has used a number of sciences as sort of crutches in these difficult theoretical issues. Psychology, Gestalt psychology in particular, psychoanalysis, linguistics, structural linguistics, etc., deconstructionist theories of literature and meaning and so forth. There is now a growing interest in the possibilities that neuroscience opens to the understanding of architecture. As it happens, I have had a chance to become friends with some of the thinkers who have been the first to combine architecture with neuroscience. And for me, that's a very promising door that is being opened to understanding ourselves and architecture in particular. But at the same time, in our society, there is a tendency, strong pressure always towards a technocratic application of all new knowledge. And this is what I'm concerned with, that neuroscience can become a new technocracy, convincing in its scientific ground. And this is what is already happening in such fields as advertising. Advertising world, I can assure you, is much ahead of architects in understanding human psychology. For instance, advertising people have understood 30 years at least to use information or images at subliminal level, images that flash only such a short while that the conscious perception does not catch them at all, but they still are caught by our unconscious neural system and they condition our behavior. I'm just suggesting that it's time for us as architects to become active in applying new sciences with certain caution. I told yesterday in a conversation at the American Academy two examples of personal examples which I think point out that empirical science can really not invent anything which human intuition cannot introduce. All empirical experimentation needs to be founded on a kind of an assumption of what the researcher wants to study, and that takes intuition to understand what you are studying. And in fact, you will never achieve anything but what you started to research. Only if you make a cardinal mistake in your whole operation, then you might end up with something else. So it is essential that anyone, even who takes an empiricist, hard scientific attitude towards things, first understands philosophically and humanly what the issues are about. I have made in a couple of my essays an assumption that maybe 15 years ago, that in artistic experience a certain kind of short circuiting takes place. Artistic experience suppresses our intellectual faculties and activates emotional faculties. 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago, I received an email from an American friend of mine who has been doing work, very serious work with functional MRI experiments with the human neural system. And he said, congratulations, Ivan, I have just proved your theory. And he was studying the reactions of human neural networks to when experiencing or confronting sacred spaces. And the experiments show precisely that when experiencing sacred spaces, intellectual faculties are suppressed, whereas the emotional faculties in all the areas in the brain are supercharged. So this is just one example of an intuitive understanding finding a empirical support. A week ago, I received a letter from Australia from a medical scholar who's studying amnesia, and the person thanked me for my writings, where I have suggested that human memory is a specialized memory, and it is attached to place. Only in exceptional cases like numerical memory, it's placeless. But at large, human memory is specialized and place bound. And anyone can make the experiment by, for instance, trying to remember a photograph. A photograph that is important to you personally, or then a masterpiece of photography. You will not be able to remember it as a two-dimensional image. You remember it as a specialized situation. So the spatial element penetrates into two-dimensional perception. And I think this the reason is very clear. The reason is biological. In early human evolution, there were no pictures, and it would not have given any evolutionary benefit for anyone to be able to read pictures, because it was essential to read spatial, three-dimensional, real-life situations. And that is what is our neural system is based on doing. And here I'm suggesting that perhaps in the next couple of decades, architecture will gain very much by studies in human evolutionary history, because architecture certainly is very deeply grounded in our primal, often collective mental contents, and the most powerful architectural images, I think, have very little to do with aesthetics. They are existentially grounded, and they draw the power, emotional power, from that existential grounding. And in fact, such studies have already been carried out. For instance, Rand Hildebrandt's couple of books, for instance, the one on Frank Lloyd Wright's Spaces, where the writer proves or shows that one reason why Frank Lloyd Wright's Spaces are so pleasurable is that he understood intuitively the polarity between prospect and refuge, the two polarities of being, feeling safety, or seeking safety, and then the need to control the environment, which again biologically is easy to understand. Those humans who have the instinct of seeking protection from behind and around, and then like to have an open field in front of the vision, survived to continue the species, whereas others who perhaps had reverse or less organized preferences were eaten up. For me, these biological perspectives have become increasingly interesting and meaningful, partly because I have been very interested in animal building behavior since my childhood at my grandfather's farm, which I mentioned. I was the only boy around within 3 or 4 kilometers radius, and I had to invent ways of spending my time, and one of the ways was to watch animal behavior, and particularly animal construction behavior. And I made in 1995 an exhibition on animal art architecture. I have continued those studies ever since. And just a couple of, or just one observation by Edward O. Wilson, the American neuroecologist, expert on ant studies, and also the biological philosopher who has introduced the attitude of biophilia, which he defines as the science and love of life. He argues that a leafcutter ant's nest alone is a more complex system in its behavior than anything that human beings have ever invented. This just as a small example of what lessons there might be in the biological world. And again, I would suggest that also the study of the biological world has to be combined with philosophical criticality in the same way that neuroscientific research has to be combined with philosophical analysis, simply for the reason that no matter how precisely scientists can photograph or record and analyze the electrochemical processes in the human neural system, the level of meaning that we experience in art or architecture is a completely different category. There is no connection between electrochemical processes and human meaning. So the human meaning has to be approached differently, and the proper method for approaching human meaning is philosophy. And in fact, now the attitude that combines philosophy and neuroscience in studying, for instance, architectural phenomena is usually called neurophenomenology, which I myself support, and in my own writings I would characterize myself as a neurophenomenologist. Well, now that I came back to the word phenomenologist, it is often, phenomenology is often in architecture schools and elsewhere treated with suspicion from several reasons, one being that phenomenology is really a first-person method, whereas our normal understanding of a scientific approach usually eliminates first-person reporting. But as far as human meaning is concerned, the first-person perspective is the only perspective to human meaning. And that is why I think it is time in architectural theory as well as the sciences altogether to widen the understanding of scientific methods and accept the first-person reporting, which is so essential in architecture. But as many of the phenomenologists argue, Gaston Bachelard, certainly a phenomenologist has to have a sincerity. Actually, Bachelard calls for naivete. He says phenomenologists have to be systematically naive, which I like the combination of being systematic and naive. But what it means is that in the first perspective, first-person perspective, you easily begin to fabricate literary, you know, stories. And as another phenomenological writer, David Seaman from University of Kansas, says, I think very clearly, there are two problems or errors in using the phenomenological method. Either you read too little into the image or you read too much. And that's a very fine description. You have to be exactly critical, and that is why I suggest, recommend reading Gaston Bachelard's books, because he was one of the most famous philosophers of science until at his mid-age he came to the observation or conclusion that if theoretically science has no possibility of saying anything about reality, only poetry can approach reality and shift its entire interest into poetic imagery. But having the background of half a life writing in philosophy of science, these expressions are extremely precise. They often sound nonsense and totally, you know, violently again common logic, but there is the logic, and they are good reading for anyone. Well, let me try to sort of close my loop. I have worked 50 years now as an architect, but I closed my office 1 year ago, and I have never consciously decided to write anything. I have just drifted into writing, and nowadays I write more and more. Here in Rome, I have been working on three books. And I still long for the long evenings with sketching paper and soft pencil and sketching architectural ideas. But about 25 years ago, I learned to write in the same way, that I never think in advance what I'm going to write, because when you begin to sketch a project, everything is born at the moment that the soft pencil hits the paper. That's where the idea is born. And it's something that is in the very moment of birth. It's already halfway outside. It's a combination of creative effort and discovery. And after I realized that I can write in the same way as I sketch, it has become a similar pleasure and discovery, and perhaps also the texts have become more meaningful for the readers, because they are perhaps more fresh, being based on personal observation rather than quasi theories. The next book of mine, which probably will come out, will be on atmospheres. And 2.5 years ago, I would not have understood what atmospheres are in architecture. But then I was invited to give a lecture in Copenhagen, mm-hmm. In a conference where the other speakers were Gernot Berner, the famous German philosopher, who has very much introduced the notion of atmosphere into architectural circles. And the third lecturer was Olaf Reliasson, the Icelandic Danish artist. And when I began to write my own lecture, I realized in 5 minutes that this is a really important issue, that atmosphere possibly could be the most important criteria for architectural quality, far beyond all the criteria that books of architecture introduce, based on form and gestalt theories. And I just suggest, having had my 77th birthday a couple of months ago, that one can learn at my age, and it is really encouraging to learn, keep learning new things. And I have no idea what will happen after the book on atmosphere. Something else will certainly emerge which attracts my interest. So I suggest to the students that open up your curiosity and maintain your curiosity, as at least as far as fighting the negative consequences of aging, curiosity is the best medicine. But I would also say curiosity makes life really interesting and rewarding. And don't make plans for your life. Let life plan itself, because by planning you destroy the chances that life and circumstances and unexpected things bring to you. So I'll stop here and answer any questions.
Lots of stimulus, ideas, and possibility to interact with you. I think that is a great opportunity for all of us. So I will do the double job of being the moderator of the talk, and also to keep the colleagues and the students and whoever wants to make an intervention, please give me a sign and I will do.
Before we go to the questions, I will send my manuscript for the lecture cover so that I will not be
talking
to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. So, while the colleagues are preparing themselves for their questions and observations and conversation, we in Italy are tend to have not the formal American way, that is the strict question and the answer. We don't have that habit. We enjoy to be with the speaker in a more formal way and to talk with you. So that will not be the format. While the colleagues and students preparing for their question and observation, of course I have so many things that I wanted to say. First of all, I have the sensation that the audience understood pretty well your lecture. I did not interrupt you. I think your English was as clean as possible. Avete capito tutti abbastanza bene? It is a level of English that should be understood by a cultured audience. So that's why I felt that it was pretty much understood that the whole voyage, he called it loop, the whole voyage. I will resume it very, very fast at some points, because I want to touch some critical point on this loop that Professor Palasma made to us.
Nebius loop.
Nebius loop. I love this. Nebius loops, because we don't believe in loops closed anymore. We believe, though, in making movements, in thinking. This type of thing. The first thing that I'm really, really impressed is some detail that apparently is secondary, but is really the key. And the key is the beginning and the end of this loop. When he described himself as a child in the country with basically nothing there but the world and the necessity to engage himself in the world, start to studying things, etc., but start to studying with, I would call it an empathy, a necessity, a joy, a way in which his body of a child was part of that world. I call this imprinting, You call the beginning phenomenology. In my writing, I call this imprinting. I really think that in the man in the progression of a civilization, as well as the progress of a man, there are moments, the imprinting moments, the first moments, are those that create some mental frame that you can go on. So, you mentioned many philosophers, I will always mention Conrad Lorenz as an important thing. So you always rethink of what we were when we were young. And basically, in a way, our life is a constant rethinking and renegotiating that moment. So the ending of the conference with the word curiosity is the normal loop that you do within that. So that message, I think, was very important, very profound, and in a way is really... is really a very subtle message, I think, that was given in this way. Then I will just talk, and somebody can be ready for the question. Valerio, you are ready? So I try to make you up. I have another part, so be ready, because after me somebody has to talk. So the other aspect that I really want to touch on this conference is the central part that I consider the central of the conference. You talk of different dichotomies that are broken in the contemporary world, and you center on one that is really very essential, is the broken of the dichotomy between self and the world. You put it, how can I say, within a phenomenology point of view. I will talk exactly of the same issue as the separation between the idea of an object in space and space. We are really in an idea of today that we are not making architecture as objects in space, but we engage our architecture with space. It's the same concept looking from different points of view, but it's exactly the same thing. Why for me it's very important, in a way it's a question that I always want for you. Because for me, I'm looking all these phenomena, the same one that you are looking, and again, this one, crucial, that there is no any more object and space, but it's a constant negotiation and mutual influencing. Because I put at the center of my thinking, and the thing that I'm trying to do, information technology. Information technology becomes the instrument, the challenge, the way that we may engage this other level in which space, body, and we can really move in another idea of space in which through information technology, through technology generally speaking, we can engage the new generation of architecture can engage space in a completely different way. So this will be my question, and sometime you will, if you want, develop on that. Because it's clearly that, in a way, for me, was a little bit... the question is, why you did not mention information technology? In an American formal thing, that would be my top question. And so, who is next? Brief intervention, a little shorter than mine, and questions. But let's have a couple of questions and then talk. I prefer this style instead of one to one. So I will have two or three, and then we'll give the word to Professor Palasma, and then again two, three, and then more or less over. That is the format. Prego, Valerio.
Thanks. I'm really interested about this. New seeing the fashion, and I'm really interested because first, because that is about the fact that the heart is useless, like Kant's thing. So it's about the heart, and back to the point is very important. And on the other hand, I'm really interested because I could say. Is about intuitions. So if art is useless and it's about intuition, there is a track that I similar to my track that starts from Kant, starting all over Schopenhauer, the body, then breathing. The breathing can arise for me to benefit from it. That's my point. But on the other hand, there is a critical aspect, and it's about Jung, the difference between novelty and facultative. So, we are talking about novelty, so we are like freestanding persons that by sense we perceive an atmosphere, we can enjoy it or not enjoy it. But the problem is that place is even a language that we use to live together. And it's not about perception, it's about, I could say, the core. It's about, the language. It's only the fight between parole and language at the end. So, this is the risk. The risk is losing the idea of architecture as a language to share a certain model of civilization in which if I think about the space by myself, immediately after, if I think, essentially think about it, I have to share with this sensation with someone else. And the moment by which I'm sharing it, the same perception shifts towards something else. So, I think this is a crucial point.
Okay. Abbiamo another observation, another... Prego, la cecola.
Very short question. So, why is the architecture applied in the sciences is becoming so rich? Why the built environment is becoming so poor?
Una terza e poi lasciamo un primo giro di risposta al professore. Prego.
I will make you one question that we've probably heard a thousand times, but I would think it would be worth saying a bit about this place today. And your work is often criticized because you do not address the cultural specificity of bodily perception. And in a way, people today say that your work lacks of historical situatedness. So you posit a kind of ahistorical subject, whereas continental philosophy in the past 70 years has worked a lot on how subjects are social constructs. So I would like to hear from you where you is your place on this, because you tend to situate architecture more if we have a broad spectrum, nature on one hand and culture on the other hand. There's a sense that you tend to put architecture more on the nature end. And then I think one more thing that you could tell us about is this research, neuroscience and architecture, which you think it is happening today in the world of which institutions and what they do?
You mean where is hotter, where is the strongest?
Where it's actually carried out.
Yes. Say, in which places?
Yes.
Okay, good. So I think you will answer to freely as you want.
You do whatever. Backwards.
As you want.
So there is an institute of neuroscience in architecture operating at the Salk Institute, the Louis Kahn Design Salk Institute in La Jolla. That's the only existing institute so far. Neuroscience in architecture is taught at the University of Arizona in Tucson. That's the only school, in my knowledge.
Yeah, as far as I know, in ETH Zurich, they're building this important pavilion called ADA in 2002 through a collaboration among mainly neuroscientists and architects and other things. I don't know if the body of the studies is formalized or not. Just a few information for you, okay?
Then the second part of your question.
Okay.
Perfect timing, ciao Andrea.
Bellissimo, bravo, bravo.
Perfect timing.
Non ho mai visto una sostituzione.
No, perché poi è più bello avere un'aula un po' più piena che una grande vuota.
Perfect timing.